Okay, Mr. Slingloff, let's just continue talking about your experience in the 1990s and particularly with regard to the wall. So you went to D.C. to visit the wall a second time,
mm-hmm.
And that was with a class that included your daughter?
Yes.
And how did that come about?
Her school was going to take a trip, and they were looking for parents to go along. So I volunteered.
Was it already decided that they were going to go to D.C.?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And was the wall something that was already on their agenda?
Yes.
Okay. How did the day that you went, what happened?
It was pretty uneventful. I went, obviously my daughter had told her class that I had been to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And so that they knew that. They really didn't. They were fairly young. And this was my younger daughter.
How old were they?
And this was in 1992, so she was about 10 years old.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We went, and the kids got it in front of the wall, and you know how you can do the etching?
Yes.
Type things. I showed them a couple of names, and specifically Larry Bell,
mm-hmm.
and a few of them took etchings of Larry's name. And, I bought they had one of the books that gives the directory of names.
Yes.
At that point. So I bought that book.
Uh-huh.
And, it was fairly uneventful. I didn't have to do a lot of teaching or organizing.
Was it moving for you?
Yeah, every time I see it. I mean, both times I've seen it, it has been.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of an amazing monument. And when you think of people, you know, the number of people who died, and the thing that I get irritated,
mm-hmm.
because people in this country didn't allow what these people were fighting for to be gained.
Can you elaborate a little?
Most of the Marines that I knew were very patriotic. We all kind of grew up with John Wayne.
Yes.
And, there was this tremendous sense of nationalism and heroism of Audie Murphy and To Hell and Back and, mm-hmm. you know, all the rest of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think that there was a much greater sense of that America is a good place, and or the United States is a good place,
mm-hmm.
and that the motives that we have as a nation are generally positive or good goals, and the people who went over believed in America, believed in the dreams of the United States, believed in freedom, believed in, God, country, mom, and apple pie,
mm-hmm.
and all the positive things of the nation, and believed that what we have here is, and I've used the term before, through the grace of God.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was born here. I didn't deserve it. I'm just here.
Yeah.
I'm not in Russia, and I'm not in Iraq. But I didn't do anything to be deserving of being here. It's just that I am.
Right.
And I think that the people I knew felt the same way, is that, we are here, we are Americans, citizens of the United States, and we've been given great gifts that were undeserved.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't to say that they weren't fought for and by previous generations, and that the gifts that we have didn't come with a price, because they did. They came with a price from previous people who had recognized the potential for this nation, mm-hmm. and what we have and the potential of freedom, and were willing to fight for it. And now it was really our turn to do it, to preserve it for future generations, not only for future generations, but to look at people around the world and say, you know, they are as deserving as we are,
right.
as human beings.
Right.
So therefore, it's our turn to try to spread what we have on a global scale.
And you felt that about the Vietnamese, that they had a right to...
Absolutely. I feel that about the, you know, any person in the world,
mm-hmm.
You know, be they from... Zimbabwe to, you know, Argentina to, you know, Colombia, whatever. You know, people around the world, people, human beings, regardless of who they are, where they're from, and you know, what their beliefs are, have the right, by the nature of human being,
mm-hmm.
to deserve freedoms and an ability to use their minds, to speak their minds, without fear. Of being killed for doing so.
And the U.S. Has in effect, would you say, a moral obligation to
I believe that.
Uh-huh.
I firmly believe. I know that there are other people who don't,
mm-hmm.
And that's fine. And I would fight for the death for them to express that opinion.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me what you're saying very much of Kennedy's inaugural speech, where he said, We will fight any enemy. We will pay any price for the defense of freedom. I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
But would you?
Well, I agree with that,
mm-hmm.
and I think that we have an obligation. One of the words that is seldom used in modern vernacular when speaking about things is responsibility.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And I believe that we as a people, every single individual in this country. Has a responsibility to see that peoples anywhere, everywhere, have the ability to live freely. We've been given something. We don't have a right to it. It was a gift.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a responsibility to see that as many people as possible can receive that gift as well.
Was some of that thinking behind what you were trying to transmit to the two different groups that you went to the wall with?
Yes. Or,
okay. And your daughter's class, they were young.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they kind of got what you were trying to?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think that at that age, there are some kids who are intellectually much farther. Along,
right.
Than others. Some may have grasped, some may not.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody like my daughter probably didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she is similar to me at 10 years old.
Mm-hmm. Which is?
Oblivious.
Okay. Uh-huh. Have you talked to her subsequently? She would be in her 20s now.
Yeah, she's 21 now.
Mm-hmm. About the war?
Yeah. And I think she understands. I bombard both my daughters,
mm-hmm.
with information. I am on the internet a fair amount with a bunch of other Marines.
Okay.
As there's kind of this network of Marines from 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines,
mm-hmm.
and we keep in touch pretty on a regular daily basis. And we find articles, we find old pictures, we find. You know, things that might be of interest, and you throw it on the net, and you let everybody kind of look at it, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some, you know, good commentary from them, and I forward a lot of it to my daughters to let them know that I'm not the only weirdo in the world.
And do they think you're weird?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my older daughter, we love getting into political discussions.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Well, she graduated from Boston University,
mm-hmm.
and she was like her mother in the fact that she was pretty academic,
mm-hmm.
and she graduated magna cum laude with two majors.
What year?
She was 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And
what are her majors?
They're history and social studies education.
Okay.
And she did an undergraduate thesis,
mm-hmm.
an honors paper, and she had picked the topic actually prior to 9/11, and it was women in Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so that she her focus on her study in history was the Middle East. And so we would get into some pretty good discussions, you know, about what's going on, and, you know, especially about politicians and
mm-hmm.
things like that.
Uh-huh.
And so that we enjoy the repartee.
You both enjoy it.
Yes.
Okay.
Drives my wife nuts.
Why is that?
But
why is the driver nuts?
Oh, just because she can't stand people talking politics because everybody's opinionated.
Right, and everyone's opinion is equally...
Right, but she doesn't understand that I will argue my opinion to the death, but at the same time, I'm absorbing some of the other arguments, and I might include those in my thought process in the future.
Right, exactly, that there's a dynamic there that's...
Right.
It's not just, I think this, and I'm not changing, and I don't care what you say.
No.
Right, exactly. Was it at sometime after your first visit to the wall... that you contacted the parents of Larry Bell?
Yes.
Okay. And was that part of, again, you rethinking? You had said that you didn't really think about Vietnam for many, many years.
Right.
And so you kind of were getting back in touch with refiguring how you wanted to assess it in your own life?
Right. Well, I wanted to find out where Larry was buried.
Okay, so it was a very kind of specific thing.
I mean, yeah, I wanted to talk with her, but I also wanted to, you know, find out where Larry was put to rest.
How did that exchange go?
I mean, it was okay. I mean, it was good. I'm very glad that I had the opportunity to talk with her.
Mm-hmm. And did she welcome speaking with you?
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we exchanged letters
mm-hmm.
A couple of times after that.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, her first letter, she kind of, you know, it was good speaking with you. I'm sorry I failed to ask if you'd been injured also.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, it was very nice. And I enjoyed that.
Okay.
Found out where Larry was laid to rest
mm-hmm.
and been over to the cemetery.
Okay. And was that helpful to you?
Yeah.
In kind of getting a grip on your own feelings about Vietnam?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there's a certain, I know it's a popular term these days, closure.
Yes.
Or whatever, but it was at least I knew where Larry was.
Right.
And, you know, so it was, and it was also on the road that's on the way to Atlantic City.
Okay.
So.
So there was a certain kind of,
yeah.
I don't know what to say, I don't know, convergence.
Yeah.
What kind of relationship have you had with the Veterans Administration?
I've never called them for anything.
Ever?
Ever.
Why?
I don't think they have anything to offer me.
Okay. So you've never had medical care or any kind of claimed any kind of benefit or anything?
No.
Do you have you ever indicated? When, say, you were applying for a job or a loan or something like that, that you were a Vietnam veteran and claim that status in any kind of
I don't know if there's any reason I should claim a status, but I don't shy away from it.
Okay.
Sometimes, I mean, I put it, you know, if it's there.
If it's there. Uh-huh. You do indicate it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever think about that the policy behind different places asking that question of potential employees or others?
You know, I've never really thought about it as a policy.
Okay.
I mean, if I found out that they were using, that somebody would be using that against people,
right?
That would be a one point where I would go on my own demonstration.
Okay.
And I would let the world know.
Right. In general,
people discriminate.
Obviously, in general, the thinking is that there's some affirmative action implication behind that question.
You mean so it'd be positive?
Yes, exactly.
I've never really thought about it. Okay. I do not believe in preferential treatment.
Okay.
I believe that people should be hired or recognized or whatever they're trying to accomplish, and other people have the power to say yay or nay for whatever they're trying to do,
mm-hmm.
that it be done on the person's abilities and or their willingness to try to perform a specific function or job or do whatever they're trying to do. I think that once you start getting into preferences, you're opening up a can of worms that is just, you know, absolutely enormous. And it's something that is tough to stop.
Mm-hmm. So you don't feel like demographics of any kind should play a role in
getting... Not really.
Uh-huh.
I think that we're running into, you know, this kind of white male persecution.
Mm-hmm.
At this point is a backlash
mm-hmm.
to whatever has gone on. But, I mean, I've never, you know, felt persecuted myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I have always felt that you're attacking a problem at the wrong end of the spectrum.
Can you explain that?
The problem comes not with somebody looking for a job.
Mm-hmm.
And being chosen based upon a non-skill criteria
mm-hmm.
doesn't, I mean, if that is how it works, then it doesn't serve either the institution that is making that decision nor the individual who is accepting it. It doesn't serve either of them well. That the problem starts with education.
Okay.
And getting away from the politically correct standards of education and getting into the minutiae of education where you're actually teaching people. Politics, once again, has played too much of a role in trying to create an educational system that is basically failing, especially in urban areas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in Baltimore,
mm-hmm.
we used to live in, and we live just outside of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And when we first moved back to Baltimore from Chapel Hill in 1978, we purchased a house inside the city. And it was in a very nice neighborhood. We loved the house and the neighborhood and all the rest of this. And then we all of a sudden had children, our first in 1980. And everything was fine and hunky-dory until all of a sudden we came to the realization that we were going to have to send our little dear to school.
Right.
And we looked at our alternatives based upon where we live. And our alternatives were we send them to the local public school, and in the previous year they had only found two dead bodies in the schoolyard.
Only two?
Only two.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, so that and we're looking at that, and we're saying, gee, that's an education in itself. or we could send her down the road to a private school, which was at $13,000 a year.
Okay.
Or we could have her transferred out of this one school district into another, which meant we'd have to drive her about 4 to 5 miles each way, because if you transfer out, they don't provide bus transportation.
Right.
And or move.
Mm-hmm.
And move into a different school district. Well, we opted to move, and we predicated the purchase of our home on the quality of the education that was available in the public sector.
Right.
And it was a great move, especially for our older daughter, who did extremely well
mm-hmm.
and benefited from the diversity of educational programs that the public schools have. Until the end of her junior year, when the school board decided that what they really needed to do was revamp the whole thing, and they brought in a guy named Stuart Berger, who had destroyed a school system in St. Louis or somewhere else.
Was he the superintendent?
Yeah, he was going to be the superintendent, but his job was to come in here and dismantle the whole system that was working. and create a system that didn't support quote-unquote elitism.
Right.
Now, elitism was the gifted and talented program which our older daughter was in.
Mm-hmm.
So but for Sarah, that was okay because she had already gotten beyond the point of the most advanced diluted class that they were going to offer in the next year. As an example, was her language and school was German.
Mm-hmm.
And they were eliminating the German class. Further up, but she needed, 3 years of a language to get into college. And so we just went to the school system and said, okay, Towson University is across the street. We're going to send her to the class in German there, and you're going to pay for it.
And did they agree?
Yeah.
Okay.
They had to.
Okay.
So that she was beyond it, and wherever she needed a course, we could find it. And we could find it either through community colleges or through Towson University.
Right.
And we pushed the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our younger daughter, who was a couple years behind this, she was going to get lost in the shuffle.
By that you mean be negatively impacted by this change?
Exactly, because the courses and what was going to be available wouldn't be available for her, as they were for our older daughter.
Right.
And so we moved her into a private school.
Did you consider sending her to the Quaker school?
No, because Friends School was a school for self-starters.
Okay. What does that mean exactly? Can you just go ahead and explain what that means?
It doesn't have a tremendous structure to it. The kids are allowed to pick their own courses, derive their own course of study. Once they've met the certain basic criteria, and there's a tremendous amount of freedom in how they structure their courses, and it's usually for kids who are academically inclined to excel, and they're of their own volition.
Right, without a lot of patterning of
right.
the curriculum. Uh-huh.
Right, and Anne was now our older daughter Sarah would have absolutely thrived. In that kind of a setting, and I wouldn't have had any problem at all sending her to Friends School.
Okay.
Because she would have done extremely well, but we already had a good public school system,
right.
So why pay 15 grand a year?
Yeah, sure.
Now, our younger daughter was like me. You had to put the positive charge in the right ear and the negative in the left ear and wake her up every morning. and it just...
That wasn't going to work for
that,
her. Well.
That would not work for her. So we sent her out to St. Paul's, which was a school with much smaller class size and greater teacher to student involvement. And it worked pretty well for her.
Okay.
I mean, she really didn't like St. Paul's that much because it also is a school with, St. Paul's for girls is a, there are a lot of little rich bitches.
Okay.
Running around.
Right.
And I mean, it's like they've got more money than sense.
Mm-hmm.
And
there's a kind of clique system.
Oh, probably... extremely clique. She's mm-hmm. just absolutely, and it drove Anne nuts.
Yeah.
Because Anne is not that type of,
right.
of person, but she found a good peer support group and good friends, and they're all extremely good friends now. And the education, or at least the structure of the education, taught her how to study.
Mm-hmm.
And now she does extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's a senior at Eckerd College in mm-hmm. St. Pete, Florida.
Yes, I know exactly where that is.
And she just, she's in, they have a search and rescue program.
Yes, uh-huh.
And she's, in that. She loves it. She's, I don't think she's gotten anything but an A for the last five semesters.
Search and rescue, do you mean air, sea, land?
Basically sea.
Okay.
I mean, their campus is right on the Tampa Bay.
Yes.
And the marina, which Anne loves, is, about 50 yards from her dorm.
And is that what she's intending to do for her career?
I mean, her major is environmental policy.
Mm-hmm.
She's talked about going to law school in policy, or, her latest thing right now is that she did an internship with Cornell University
mm-hmm.
last summer, and it was in their fisheries program. where she was. She likes to scuba dive as well. She's a good athlete,
right?
And she's a strong girl. She's, you know, she's another one of our 6-footers. So she. You know, she loves doing things that are outdoorsy, and so the person who is the head of the program at Cornell said that if she wanted to come back next year, that would be great, and if she wanted to go to graduate school, he was on staff at Cornell in the faculty, and,
okay.
and to give him a call.
Super.
And she was thinking of going into their forestry program.
Well, it's a good school.
Yep.
Let me ask you, Dev, have you spent much time reading the many, many, many books that have been published about Vietnam?
Yes.
Which would you say, can you pick out two or three that you think are really good and maybe a couple that are not so good?
There was A Bright Shining Lie.
Yes.
Sheehan.
Yes.
I enjoyed that one. We Were Soldiers, Once and Young.
Yes.
Which was General Moore. I enjoyed that. After Tet.
Yes.
By Spector.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a follow-up to A Bright Shining Lie. It says After the War Was Over, and that's another Sheehan book.
Mm-hmm.
I've read those. Then there are a bunch of kind of Marine type books, which are just kind of stories and things like Semper Fi.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnam. I've read that.
Semper Fi, the book that kind of gives a sort of operational overview of
mm-hmm.
the Marines in Vietnam.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And it's a fair number.
Are there some you've read that that you think were pretty bad?
I've tried to stay away from them.
Okay. Is this one of the things that that you and some of the other 3-1 veterans talk about on the internet?
On occasion.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really talk about the books that much.
Okay. What about movies?
I thought Oliver Stone was horrific.
Okay.
I mean,
Which film, please?
Oh, this was, I don't know, what Platoon?
Yes. Uh-huh.
I thought that was disgusting.
Okay, why?
Because he used what were realistic emotions, and he transferred them into sensational savagery. I understand the dichotomy between good and evil and the players who are in on this thing and all the rest of that garbage, but that's been played over 150,000 times with 150,000 different subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And his portrayal of drug abuse by a combat unit to me was just off the wall.
Uh-huh.
The savagery of going into a village and killing people, was a play on My Lai.
Yes.
which I think was just, after My Lai happened, there were the pundits who were out there. Well, this is just the tip of the iceberg, where there were thousands of them. Everybody was out there murdering, and it did. So it's such a great disservice to veterans all over, to veterans who, went over and had really good motives for being there and were very moral people and very ethical people. And they were looking to treat people as they would want to be treated themselves. And I think Oliver Stone just did a horrible job.
Do you think that the stereotypes that he relied on in that film, were just was he doing that just to sell tickets, or was there some larger commentary on the war that he was making?
I have no idea what his commentary on the war is.
Okay.
I just thought that it was such a disservice to the greatest majority of people who served honorably.
And it made you mad.
Oh, it infuriates me.
Right. Any other films from about Vietnam that...
I mean, Apocalypse Now, I think, is absurd.
Okay. Can you say something about that?
Not much positive.
That's okay.
I mean, it just... You've got this kind of like cowboy atmosphere of this guy who gets off, you know, I mean, it's just weird. And I forget the book that it is based upon. But it was not Vietnam. He took another incident out of some other book that was relating to, I think, a war in the Middle Ages or something.
Okay, I didn't know that.
And it just, you know, it just, I forget the name of it, but he was taking it and creating a modern-day version of this whole thing, mm-hmm. and it was just not realistic. I thought that the Deerslayer thing, you know, with the Russian roulette,
yes. uh-huh.
was just, I mean, talk about something that is so far from reality.
Mm-hmm.
It just, and to try to pin that on Vietnam, but you have people who believe that garbage.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And, you know, if it's just a story and everybody knows that this is just absolute blathering fiction, then fine.
Uh-huh.
Okay, do your story, make your movie, whatever it is, but don't try to portray it as some sort of, you know, possible or factual happening. You know, this is how it was when it wasn't. You know, I mean, those are the three that I think are just, I'm not real happy with.
Right.
But I don't know if any war films with any era,
mm-hmm.
are in any way realistic. I did enjoy We Were Soldiers. That was
the Mel Gibson
movie.
Recent film with Mel Gibson.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed, but they weren't making a political statement
right.
in there.
Yeah, do you think that's the failing of the previous three movies, Apocalypse Now, Deerslayer, Platoon?
Mm-hmm. There's a political
okay.
agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas We Were Soldiers, there's no political agenda. It basically showed what happens during a battle.
Right. Okay.
I mean, yes, there was a little bit of you know, blood sensationalism at times,
mm-hmm.
But that's not unlike, you know, Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, what was your appraisal of that film?
I mean, I thought it was interesting. I thought it was unrealistic.
In what way? Because your father was involved in events that...
Well, I mean, running after this one private.
Okay.
You know,
okay. So the premise of the story...
You know, we do that. I tried that in Vietnam, running around trying to get this one person I know to satisfy the press.
Okay. So the whole premise was kind
of... Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. the premise was bad. I think the invasion scene gave a very graphic description of what it could have been like to try to land in that kind of a situation.
The scene at the beginning of the film.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But then the rest of it was a fiction.
Do you, as a result of not liking, for example, The Deerslayer or Apocalypse Now, avoid other films by or that have, you know, Robert De Niro or Francis Ford Coppola involved?
No.
Okay. So,
no, I want to hear what people have to say.
Okay.
I especially want to hear what people have to say who disagree with me.
Mm-hmm. Because that's more interesting to you.
Right.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting, but I also, you know, it generally buoys my opinions.
It buoys your own opinions.
Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about your travel to and your interest in the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
That you developed as an undergraduate.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, did you go to China?
I've been to China twice.
Okay. Did you go as a tourist or a businessman?
A tourist.
Okay.
Just purely wanted to see it.
Where did you go?
The first time was with my younger daughter's class out at St. Paul's.
Okay.
And their history teacher was organizing a trip over spring break. And they were looking for not only students to go along, but they were hoping that they could get chaperones, and so I jumped at the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And did you and your wife both go?
No, just my daughter and I.
Oh, okay.
And along with you know, the Alan James, who organized the trip for St. Paul's, and a number of the other students, some of whom were of Anne's group.
Mm-hmm.
So that she was very comfortable
of
with
her
it.
Friends, her
yeah,
her close friends.
And actually, two of the girls who went were from our neighborhood, right here. One lives about a block from us, and the other lives about two blocks from us. And they, Ann and these two girls had been to elementary school and middle school together.
Oh, wow. Great.
And then on to St. Paul's. And so they went, and they were having trouble finding enough kids to go. And to me, it was crazy because the price was right and the opportunity was incredible.
Sure.
And you've got all these people who have more money than sense.
Sure.
And their girls were worried about going down to Florida and working on their tan. Okay.
Uh-huh.
I mean, let's go to China. Let's do something that's you know, really neat. But we went to China. We landed in Shanghai,
mm-hmm.
and the one of the purposes of the trip, and we went with the headmistress of the school of St. Paul's, and we visited a school in China, a girls' school in Shanghai, that was a sister school to a Japanese girls' school,
mm-hmm.
which was the sister school of St. Paul's.
I see. So there's a relationship.
Yeah, and they were trying to see if they could work out some sort of exchange with the Chinese school.
Wonderful. Uh-huh.
And I think they're still working on it, but it hasn't come to fruition yet.
What year was this?
This would have been about 1999, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Or probably 98. And, you know, we stayed in Shanghai for a day or so, and then we went to Wuhan.
Yes.
And we did the trip up the Yangtze.
Okay.
We wanted to do that before they were flooding it.
Yes, before the big project.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we went up to Chongqing.
Mm-hmm.
And from Chongqing, we went to Beijing, and then on home. So that it was really an abbreviated trip, just because it was spring break and we didn't have enough time to do all the things that we wanted to. But
yeah.
We, you know, saw the Great Wall and you know, went to the Ming tombs and you know, got a pretty good overview of you know, the what was going on there.
Was this your first visit to Asia since being in Vietnam?
Yes.
Did you have any kind of echo from your having been in Vietnam when you landed in China?
No.
Nothing?
Nothing really. I mean, I spent probably the month and a half or 2 months before pulling out the old tapes and getting some new tapes so that I could get used to listening to the tonality of the language and perhaps refreshing some of my vocabulary.
Okay. How'd that go?
Well, it was interesting. You know,
yes.
Here I am driving down the road speaking Chinese to myself. I mean, you know, it's pretty bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I found that I could understand much more than I could speak because my brain wouldn't get in gear fast enough to try to respond.
Right, but you could hear something.
But I could hear things and get gists.
Mm-hmm.
And so it helped in that with that respect. And then the second trip was 2 years ago.
Okay.
And this one came about because the we have an interim pastor of our church,
mm-hmm.
and he wanted to take a trip to China, and asked if anybody was interested in going. And I had given such a glowing report of it, and I told Deborah, I said, you know, you've got to go, too.
Is that your wife?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so Deborah and I and both of our daughters went this time.
And how long did you stay this time?
And we spent, I guess it was 16 or 17 days, and we did a lot of the same thing. This time we landed in Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
We spent a little bit more time there. We saw many of the same things, but also some additional things. Then we went down to Wuhan and did the trip up the Yangtze again. It was a different tour service up there, so we, on our stops up the Yangtze, we actually stopped at different places,
mm-hmm.
which was good, so I wasn't repeating everything that I'd seen before. And then we went and saw the terracotta soldiers in Xi'an, which was just, I mean, that was really neat. That is something else. And by this time, our daughters were old enough that they could get a fair amount of independence and moving around. And our tour guide was a guy who his parents had been art historians and artifact appraisers and lived in Xi'an.
Wow. Okay.
And so once he got to Xi'an, which was his home territory, he could kind of take off his hat of being tour guide when he was on his own time, and got a bunch of his friends together and brought them by and picked up the girls, our girls and a couple of other girls who were traveling with us, and they all went out to some Chinese nightclubs and things.
That sounds like a great trip.
So that, I mean, they had a great time.
Yeah.
It was really wonderful.
Yeah.
And, you know, then we went from there to Guangzhou.
Mm-hmm.
And spent a couple of days at Guangzhou
and then
took the train to Hong Kong. A couple of days in Hong Kong and then home.
Okay. And what, on either or both of these trips, how was it for you to be in a communist country? Did you think about it?
Well, yeah, I thought about it. But I also recognized that China, especially Beijing, is probably the most capitalistic place I've ever seen except for Hong Kong.
Can you describe that?
Well, everything's for sale. I mean, you know, it's just, I mean, everything is for sale. And everybody's out trying to make a buck.
Now, do you mean people on the street peddling things?
People on the street, the businesses, it's a really thriving place in terms of trade and what they're selling. They've gotten away. When I first went over, they still had the government stores.
Yes.
And they've gotten away from that. That really doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so actually some pricing power has hit the private sector. Unfortunately, because I wanted to buy a couple of the silk rugs,
and they
quintupled in price in 2 years.
Yeah.
So that's
the free market.
Yeah, that's the free market aspect of it. I mean, which is good for them.
Right.
Things had changed while I was there, but I think that the communist government is holding the end of the tiger's tail, and they're in trouble.
Why do you say that?
Just because capitalism is really de facto how the place works.
Okay.
And they've got a country of how many billion people that they're trying to keep under control.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, you know, they aren't going to be able to roll the tanks through Tiananmen Square and knock off everybody. I think they're either going to have to change, or they're going to be run over. Now, I don't know how long it'll take, and with the Chinese, their concept of time is a little bit different than ours.
Yes. Can you say something about that?
They tend to be a lot more patient than we are. We tend to be in a culture of immediate gratification.
Mm-hmm.
I see it, I want it, and what do I see next? And then I want that.
Right.
And I think that they see the things that they are trying to obtain, and they're a little bit more patient in figuring out how to obtain it and probably do it in a more effective way than we would.
And you think that kind of informs some of the processes of political change there?
Yes.
Okay. Uh-huh. Well, have you thought about going to Vietnam?
Yes.
Gone back. What are you thinking about it?
I'd like to go. Mm-hmm. I understand that there are some tours that you can get yourself connected with.
Yes.
And go back. I'd love to do it.
Okay.
The thing that I think is holding me back is that Well, first we had the two trips to China, and last year my wife wanted to go to England and Scotland, and we did that. Mm-hmm. And then I told you about our relatives in South Africa, and they threatened to come over and pull us over there by the fingernails if we didn't go.
Right.
And my kids want to go to South Africa, you know, because they met their cousins and they all hit it off real well.
Great.
And so they want to interact with the cousins there. So I think that there are a few things that are, you know, that we've either accomplished already,
right,
or that are on the horizon that have taken priority over Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, I will go back. Now, I thought I was going to go back a couple of years ago because some friends of ours were in Bangkok. And he was the head of what's the company that makes diapers?
Kimberly-Clark?
Kimberly-Clark.
Mm-hmm.
He was the head of Asian division of Kimberly-Clark.
Oh, okay. Do you know, just out of curiosity, can you tell me his name?
It's John... Wait a minute.
I'm putting you on the spot.
Spelled J-O-N.
Okay. Well, I have a family connection to Kimberly-Clark. Pretty much at that level, and I was just wondering.
Let's see. They live. They have a house across the lake from us, up in the Adirondacks.
Oh, okay. Anyway, so you were thinking about going out to Bangkok?
Yeah.
They were there. Uh-huh.
And they had a house there, and so that I would, you know, have the ability to Larkin.
Larkin.
John Larkin.
Uh-huh. Very good.
Trying to pull all this stuff out.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, let's extract it. But that just didn't happen. They've actually now been transferred to, and they're living in South Korea.
Mm-hmm, okay.
But at any rate, they're over there, but we just didn't make the connection.
Right. If and when you do go back. Where would you like to go?
I'd like to spend most of my time probably. I'd love to go up to Hue.
Yes.
Because I think that would just be fascinating to see the old city.
And you never got there. Right?
And I never got there.
Right.
I'd like to go to Hanoi, and I understand that they have some great pottery.
Mm-hmm.
Those big pottery pieces.
Mm-hmm.
That's west of there, and I know that my wife would love to see that. Because she's big in the pottery.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if she'd be as big as those things are, but
yeah.
It would be kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
And then I'd like to spend a good deal of time around Da Nang. I'd like to be able to get a Jeep and take off. I don't know if that's possible. But just drive some of the roads.
And would you be looking for, do you think you'd look for things that are familiar? Or would you just like to kind of be there again?
Well, I'd like to be there again. I'd like to look for things that are familiar. However, through the network, 3-1 network,
mm-hmm.
some of the people have been back, and their commentary was, if you're looking for the things that are familiar, don't, because it's been 35 years and everything's changed.
Mm-hmm.
However, some of the roads would still exist,
yes.
and some of those villages, I'm sure, are still there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if any of the people whom I met are still alive or what has happened, but I'd like to just be able to walk through them again.
What do you think that would do for you? How do you think that would affect you?
You know, I don't know.
Okay.
I wouldn't have the slightest idea of what my reaction would be. Right now I don't believe I'm big into flashback,
mm-hmm.
so that I don't think that would really affect me. But who knows? I mean, I don't know.
But you'd be interested in finding out.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about how your Vietnam experience affects your thinking about current events. You've alluded to this, but I wonder if you had anything to say about the deployment of U.S. troops to Iraq and any parallels or things that deployment makes you think about Vietnam or how Vietnam makes you think about Iraq.
There are similarities that I think are being set up by the press coverage
right.
of what is going on in Iraq.
Uh-huh.
And the similarities would not only be the media, but also, once again, the politicians.
Okay.
I mean, I think that Hillary Clinton going over there to Afghanistan and then to going into Iraq, saying what she said to the soldiers there about, you know, the people back in this country not really kind of supporting what Bush is doing, but they're there anyway. I think that's tantamount to Jane Fonda, you know, sitting on an anti-aircraft weapon
mm-hmm.
and saying, "I'm an American, but we don't support you."
Go ahead.
I think that undermines, you know, what the soldiers are trying to do. I think that, and then having Hillary Clinton, I mean, just think about this. Hillary Clinton
mm-hmm.
giving military advice. Now, is there any greater oxymoron that ever existed? I mean, what does she know about anything military?
Mm-hmm.
But she's a politician, so therefore she knows it all, so therefore she's going to, you know, once again, I would defend to the death her right to say it.
Right.
But I think that she is being such a horse's ass.
Okay.
That it's unbelievable.
Uh-huh. And you're drawing a parallel to her and to Jane Fonda.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say something about how you felt about the Jane Fonda's trip to Hanoi?
Well, I think that they should have executed her.
You think who should have?
We should have.
Okay, the United States?
Yeah, I think she should have been
charged
taken up, charged.
Okay.
And criminally, you know, exposed for what she did. I think that it was absolutely unforgivable.
Was it aid and comfort to the enemy?
Yeah, I think so. I think absolutely it was.
And have you heard her speak about what she did? Do you recall seeing, for example, her interview on ABC's program?
You know, you asked me a question earlier. Did
uh-huh.
I, you know, look at Coppola films and things like that?
Yes.
Afterwards, and I said, sure. She is the only person I will not. I don't care what she's doing.
Okay.
I will not listen to her. I
okay.
will not look at her.
Uh-huh.
My detestation for that woman just has. I mean, there's. She is on her own pedestal with how much I dislike her.
And nothing she could do at this point?
There is nothing she could do at this point.
Okay. And would you say that's that you are alone in that feeling?
No.
Okay. That kind of, that the degree of disgust with her persists?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I know it exists.
Okay, how do you know?
Through the 3-1 network.
Okay, and guys talk about it.
Oh, yeah.
Still.
Yes. Absolutely.
Wow. And you see sort of Hillary Clinton for some of the things that she's done with regards to the deployment in Iraq as...
Of the same ilk.
Maybe it's
I mean, I think that she does it out of total ignorance.
Okay.
I mean, for the smartest person in the world, she's the stupidest person I've ever seen.
Do you think she's very intelligent?
I think that she has. She is intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that she uses her intelligence.
How so?
I just don't believe that anybody can come to the conclusions that she comes to with if they've thought about them. I mean, she is a politician, and she's when she goes to a place like Iraq and makes statements like she made, I think is in the process of cutting her own political throat, which I, you know, don't necessarily object to. I'm glad to see that she does things like that.
Uh-huh.
But what she said is going, if she runs for further office,
yes.
is going to be used against her. I bet that, to my bottom dollar, that, what she did and what Jane did are going to come up in the same sentence globally or nationally.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's a very intelligent person,
mm-hmm.
but an intelligent person who's thinking wouldn't have done what or said what she said.
And do you think she will run for office? outside of the office that she currently holds?
Yeah, I mean, she got that office because she ran against somebody nobody had ever heard of. And that was because what's-his-name had kind of cut his own political throat by getting divorced, and then it wasn't his fault that he had cancer. But
Pataki?
Yeah, no, it wasn't. Was it Pataki? No, it wasn't.
It was the former governor. I can't remember at the moment. Yeah,
I mean, my mind went blank.
I'm sorry.
I think that that's the only reason she won there.
Yes.
And so, therefore, she won an office. She's now a senator. She's trying to bide her time. I don't think that she's going to try to run this time around. I think Howard Dean has too much momentum, especially after Al Gore gave the endorsement. I think that his stance on a lot of things is going to come back and get him. So I think that Bush will win again.
Okay.
Then after Bush is out, I think that she'll run. I think she'll try to make a run for the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
And
do you think that the parallel to her to Jane Fonda will be a factor there?
I think it will,
mm-hmm. Particularly with veterans.
Yes.
Okay.
Very much so.
Let's talk about the veterans community. You're hooked in a bit because of this because of the way in which the internet has created kind of online communities.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly with your unit. And you did mention earlier that you had gone to a reunion.
Right.
Do you see yourself going to reunions as the years go on?
Occasionally. There's one that's going to take place in October of 2004 in St. Louis.
Okay, is that a 3-1 reunion?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm going to go to that. There's another corpsman from 3-1 whom I've been corresponding with,
mm-hmm.
and evidently he does have some PTSD problems.
Okay.
And through the internet, I've been trying to lend support to him,
mm-hmm.
and he wants to go to that reunion, which would be his first, and he would like it if I was there.
Yeah.
I would be, I'd like to go and I'd like to see him again.
Is this someone that you actually remember from
in
country?
Mm-hmm.
Was the reunion that you attended very difficult? I know that you said you saw someone that you had worked on, who I believe was a double entity.
Mm-hmm.
Was it difficult for you to go?
It was not difficult for me to drive up there.
Was it difficult for you to be there?
It was difficult. I saw a fair number of people, and I was happy I went.
Yes.
Otherwise, I wouldn't be considering going to St. Louis.
Right.
I enjoyed speaking with the people. Seeing some of the people again reminded me of how old I am. I'm going, oh my God, do I look like that? Ooh,
it's a little frightening there.
Oh man, okay. I mean, talk about a picture of reality.
Uh-huh.
it was good to see them. Yeah, I mean, it was tough to see some of the people. I mean, it was tough to see Bob,
mm-hmm.
Especially since I was convinced that he was not alive.
Right.
But I went through it, did it.
Might it be easier to go to the next one because of the time that you spent on the internet, kind of connecting with people in a different way?
It may be.
Okay. The internet's changing everything,
mm-hmm.
and it's making it possible to find people as well,
right.
as communicate with them once you found them. Have you used the internet to try to locate other people who you knew in Vietnam who you thought you might like to catch up with?
Yes, I have.
have you actually succeeded in finding anyone?
I've run into another corpsman who was over there. I've talked occasionally with a guy who is a radioman from our platoon.
Mm-hmm.
I've run into I would guess about half a dozen or so people, and I wonder, other than Vietnam, how much we have in common.
Yeah, right. And you sort of felt that way when you were there, too.
Mm-hmm.
You said that you felt like an anomaly, I think you said.
Right.
And some of that still is there?
Some of it is still there, a little bit. You try to get rid of it.
Right.
I mean, because that just creates an artificial barrier, which shouldn't exist.
Right. Let me ask you in general about the United States government's relationship with veterans.
Mm-hmm.
You said you don't have anything really to do with the Veterans Administration.
Right.
Do you think that the United States has recognized and treated well its Vietnam veterans?
Probably not. I think that although I understand that there have to be certain budgetary constraints on any program, I think that the veterans programs should carry one of the highest priorities.
In the national budget?
In the national budget.
Mm-hmm.
These are the people who were willing to put their lives on the line to make sure that this country, exists. That it's there for future generations, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And that it should be it's just an absolute high priority for the veterans to be treated, appropriately if they have medical problems, anything related to service, they should be covered by. I think that if anybody needed a national medical program for when some of these guys are retiring and reaching kind of the twilight of their years, that they should have a place respects who they are and what they've done and recognizes it. I was at a mall I guess about a month ago, a month
mm-hmm.
and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there, it was in the middle of the week, and I had gone out, visited a client, and was coming back in. I had to pick up something at a hardware store that was in the mall and then grab some pizza. And I was out in kind of the common area in the middle of the mall and was looking for a place to sit down so I could chomp down on the food.
Right.
And there's this guy sitting there at the table, and he recognizes that I'm looking for a place, and he says, "Hey, have a seat." And I said, I thanked him and
mm-hmm.
sat down, and he was kind of wearing one of these hats from some, USS something or other.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what the ship was. And, I asked him if, he'd been in the Navy, and yeah, he was, and he'd been in World War II and all the rest of this. And,
uh-huh.
and it was really neat talking to the guy. And he's kind of this old gomer who I'm sure that, I will be one day, and the people who are walking by don't pay a bit of attention to him or whatever it is, and they don't recognize what this guy's been through, what he's done.
Right.
And I think people like that deserve absolute respect.
Mm-hmm.
He was living a fine life and all the rest of that. And, he went to the mall and he walked around the mall to get his exercise. And,
sure.
He and a couple of his friends would meet up and they'd drink coffee and BS and then go home. And it was part of their routine.
Mm-hmm.
And it was good to see that they had a great routine and enjoyed each other's company, et cetera.
Right.
But I've also seen in some VA hospitals, because there's one that is not too far from us, where some of these guys who are in the twilight of their years, the situation isn't that great. And I'm sensitive to this because we've just moved my mother into a nursing home.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, you know, the amount of time and effort that we've put in trying to find the right place so that she is comfortable, so that, you know, psychologically she can deal with her now situation,
yes.
which is one where it's not going to change.
And
that sort of respect, and we have, you know, some finances to cover it.
Right.
And which makes a great deal of difference.
Yes.
But I think that there should be a way to, when you're looking at veterans, of say, you know, out of appreciation, saying, you know, we can do better in terms of the facilities that are available to you and the care that you're going to be given.
Is it your sense that that there's been kind of a chronic or many years of underfunding of, for example, medical care?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. And are you thinking that they should have, they, including you, should have some guarantee from the government in terms of medical care that goes beyond what's currently offered by the VA?
I think that it could be done on a need-based criteria.
Okay. Uh-huh.
You know, I'm not generally in favor of need-based things.
Mm-hmm.
When our daughters were looking for schools,
right.
You know, I thought that the need-based criteria as the only criteria didn't reward kids. I didn't care if it was Bill Gates. If Bill Gates has a kid who is getting straight A's and in a tough school and has a challenging curriculum, that person on their own merit should be able to get a merit scholarship somewhere.
Right, and it doesn't work that way.
And it doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, Boston University had merit scholarships. That's one of the reasons that Sarah chose that.
Okay.
She said, you know, there are going to be some bright people going to this place.
Sure.
This is where I want to go.
Right.
And, but, so need-based in terms of veterans who apply, you know, for benefits, I think that it should be there so that they can apply and that they can receive the benefits that they deserve.
Okay. Do you have any...
I mean, I don't want it for myself.
Understood. Right.
I'll take care of me and
right.
you know, whatever.
But you recognize that there are people who aren't in that position.
Right.
If they're veterans, they perhaps some particular recognition from the government is not appropriate.
Right.
Okay. Do you have any observations to make on the continuing search by the United States government in cooperation with Vietnamese and Laotian governments for men who did not come home from Vietnam?
For the families of these people,
mm-hmm.
A final resolution is desirable. But is there a point when you say, you know, enough's enough?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I would imagine that if I was, you know, if I were looking for somebody in particular, that I would want it to go on forever.
Over the years, have you followed that U.S. policy on engagement with the Vietnamese government even before diplomatic recognition?
I've read about it.
Okay. Did there was no one from 3-1 that you know of who did not come back?
Not that I'm aware of.
Oh, okay. I wonder if that's something that the 3-1 internet group ever mentions. Talks about.
I have not seen it.
Is that right?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. What would you say are the principal issues that the guys on the web talk about? Are they talking about their families, and what's going on in their lives now, or are they talking about Vietnam?
They're mainly talking about Iraq.
Okay.
Some of them have sons who are there.
Mm-hmm.
And could you hang on just a second?
Absolutely, sure.
My other phone is ringing.
Okay. Deb, what was the most significant thing that you learned while you were in Vietnam?
Most significant thing.
Mm-hmm. It could be about you, or it could be about the world.
Well, I think it was about me.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I try not to be, you know, totally egocentric.
That's all right. Actually, that's probably okay.
But it was a greater degree of self-reliance. That I could, you know, accomplish a lot of things.
And was that something that you carried forward?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I could react to things quickly. I found out that I have a good decision-making ability, you know, in a stressful situation.
Right.
And can react pretty quickly without having to debate and generally come up with the appropriate response.
Okay. You said earlier, I think yesterday, that the war has affected your entire life.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just talk about that for a second? How do you see that? It's affected everything that's come afterwards.
Well, I think that it's made me, gave me greater cognizance of the of global situations and things, and created a need for me to understand the dynamics of global political decisions and how they're, you know, how people arrive at them.
That you wanted to pay attention to.
That I want to pay attention to.
Okay.
It has made a change in that I have a desire to pass on to future generations a sense of what I believe the United States is and represents, and our responsibility as a nation and as individuals within that nation to a global community.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I've mentioned that I taught a couple of classes. I taught one over at another school, I guess about a month and a half ago.
Okay. This is you lecturing to a class?
It's lecturing to a class.
Okay.
I've done this several times.
Mm-hmm.
Alan James, whom I went to China with, I went to several of his history classes.
Mm-hmm.
And talked with the kids about Vietnam, and it's not the personal experience. I mean, the personal experience at this point are really anecdotal.
Uh-huh. Dotal. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's you know, the, I mean, those are just stories. What's important is where we are now and where we go.
Okay.
And that's always been important. History is history. You learn from history. You learn from the things of the past, and you constantly learn from the things of the past. What you learn it changes. It doesn't mean what happens changes. It means that your view of what happens changes.
Yes. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And you use that history to see where you are and where you want to go and what is important and what is not important. And for me, trying to relate to younger people,
mm-hmm,
who are at an age where they can understand the distinctions I try to make, that is very important to me.
And those are the reasons really for looking back at the war now?
So those are reasons for looking back at it so that I can understand it more fully.
Yes, your understanding is very different in 2003 than in 1983 or whatever.
It changes so very much, you know, from, you know, 1973 to 83 to 93 to 2003.
Right, exactly.
It's a process. I mean, I've written some things down that, you know, back in the mid-1980s or actually early 1990s,
mm-hmm.
when I was first beginning to talk about it and really think about it. And I look back at what I've written then, and then I see where I am now, and I see an evolution of thought that has been bolstered by study of the situation, reading the books,
mm-hmm.
you know, listening to my friends on the internet, looking at today's situations, you know, today's history,
right.
Which is not an oxymoron.
Right.
You know, seeing where I've come and the evolution of it. I mean, it's so that for me, yes, it has been a very important part of my life, but it's more for the ability to transmit the information that I have to people, hoping that they can begin to understand the love that I have for this country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it may sound corny, but it's what has happened recently. The things that John Ashcroft has done to freedoms in this country. I'm really a civil libertarian at heart. I think
this is Attorney General John.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of the restrictions on freedom, I think are counterproductive to what this entire country was about.
Are you talking about the Patriot Act?
Yes.
And what specific elements of it?
Oh, I mean, it affects me every day of my business when I'm trying to deal with my clients.
How?
The paperwork that I have to go through. I tried to open up a brokerage account for my daughter for her 21st birthday. Where I could buy her some stock.
Okay.
I couldn't do it because she was down in Florida, and I couldn't get her signature on the documents, and I couldn't verify who she was because I didn't have her driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
I was only there at her birth.
Right.
I mean, I know who she is.
Right.
And I can't open an account because of the bureaucratic mishmash.
Mm-hmm.
That I have to go to
mm-hmm.
or go through.
Are there other pieces of it too that concern you?
Yeah. I mean, I went up to see the statue, not the statue, the Liberty Bell.
In Philadelphia.
Yeah. I hadn't been up there in years, and we decided to take a day trip up there.
Okay.
Or actually an overnight
mm-hmm.
With another couple. And, you know, go out and have a nice dinner and see the historic places within Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
and they've got these metal detectors that, you know, to go in to see the Liberty Bell.
Right.
And I almost had to undress in order to get into the place to see it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't know what was setting, you know, their metal detectors off. I have no clue.
How did that make you feel?
It made me feel, I was really angry. I mean, when I finally got through to the place, I walked through it, didn't even look at the bell, and just walked outside. I just said, you know, Liberty Bell, right. I said, give me a break.
Yeah, there's a little irony there.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, you have invaded my person
mm-hmm.
so that I can go in and see this thing which says it declared liberty throughout this country. Yeah, that does not work for me.
Do you take as a given the purposes behind that, the new, much more intensive sort of body search security?
I understand that. But
okay.
But in this day of political correctness, they have taken what might be a reasonable response to the situation
mm-hmm.
and turned it completely unreasonable.
How?
Well, I've done a fair amount of flying
yes.
Through the course of the last few years, you know, going down to Florida to visit our daughter there, up to Boston to see our other daughter, you know, whatever.
Right.
And we fly around a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And you see who they're searching in airports.
Who are they searching?
I mean, you know, I've seen them search, you know, little old ladies.
Right. Right.
Yeah, Right. This woman is a terrorist.
Right.
You know, and you know, it's just there is no common sense that is being used or guiding it, because the guiding principle is now political correctness. I used to think that being a discriminating individual was a positive connotation. Now if I discriminate, my God, I'm the worst criminal that this country has ever seen.
When you say the political correctness is sort of informing, for example, who's getting heavily screened at airports and so forth, for people, you know, 25 or more years from now who aren't using our vernacular, what does that mean?
What, political correctness?
Yeah, and how that plays out in this situation.
Okay. Political correctness is I guess it's more of a speech, or how you use language and how you implement your how you conduct your life in terms of your references to people of other races, religions, origins. Political correctness is an oversensitivity. I mean, if I, several times during this interview, I've made reference to God.
Yes.
God is not politically correct.
Why?
Well, because if you try to do this in a school setting, in a public school setting, then it's a violation of church and state. It's not politically correct to make a reference to a deity or whom you believe in, because you might be possibly offending somebody who doesn't believe in that deity.
Okay. So
and it's a matter of how you speak and how you act that can offend absolutely nobody.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that means that nobody's allowed to speak.
Okay. And how does that, right? And how does that play out, for example, at the airport example where they're searching old ladies in wheelchairs and so forth?
Well, you know, if they try to discriminate and isolate somebody who might look to be of Arab descent, and say, okay, you're more likely to be a terrorist than an 85-year-old white-haired lady, then you've discriminated against the Arab, and it is not politically correct to do so. Now, if I were Arab and was being searched, I might be a little bit irked on this thing, but I would also have to be smart enough to realize that there's a reason behind it. And the reason behind it might be that people of my appearance would be more likely to blow up a plane than a little old lady in a wheelchair.
Or at least have in the past done so.
Right. I mean, so that our experience has said that I would be more like. Now, to me, as an Arab, I would go back to the word of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say, well, maybe I, as an Arab, should take it along with other Arabs who do not blow up airplanes upon ourselves to try to correct this impression by, I don't know, blowing the whistle on those who would blow up planes, or taking responsibility for, our group, whatever that might be. We had a guy from who is from an Islamic temple in Baltimore, or mosque in Baltimore, come and speak at our church, and this was right after 9/11, and he was trying to make the point that the greatest majority of the people in Islam do not believe in what the extremists are doing, and that it is an extreme arm of Islam that is carrying out the war or the jihad against the United States, and saying that it is not, this is not the general belief, that most people in Islam are, as a matter of fact, quite passive and in their beliefs, and are probably more akin to Quakers than they are to, you know, somebody who is willing to blow anything up.
Right.
And I asked him the question. I said, well, don't you feel that you, as one who professes Islam, isn't it your responsibility or part of your responsibility, and those who are like you, who are pacifist in nature, to take responsibility for what is happening to your religion,
mm-hmm.
and do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's,
that's against our religion, because that would be, I'm going, okay, fine. But if that is their attitude, then they should, bear the brunt of the searches at airports.
Mm-hmm.
And if they do something about it, then perhaps in the future they might not be searched.
Right.
And it's their responsibility to do it.
And more broadly, you have concerns about this Patriot Act's impact on personal freedoms here.
Yes.
Do you see that receding, or do you see it?
I think it is, with my wife being a librarian, who's and the library community has gone nuts about this thing,
mm-hmm.
because they passed into law, or part of the law of the Patriot Act was an ability to go in and screen the reading habits of any of the patrons of various libraries, mm-hmm. without having a search warrant.
And how did they do that?
How
would the government do that?
Well, I don't know. The libraries aren't cooperating with them. But
okay.
according to the law, mm-hmm. they would have the right to do that. And Ashcroft's response to that is, we aren't going to do that. Mm-hmm. It's there, mm-hmm. but we're not doing that. Nobody's ever done it in the past. Why would you think we would do that in the future? Well, gee, Mr. Ashcroft, I wonder. If you have the ability, somebody's going to do it.
And this presumably rests on utilizing the internet and book checkout records and all that sort of thing.
Correct.
Okay. And the librarians that your wife is familiar with, now she works at Johns Hopkins University,
mm-hmm.
And the librarians in her community, whatever, mm-hmm. are kind of not being cooperative?
They're hoping not to be.
Okay.
And I mean, they've never really been confronted with it. But the fact is, it's in the law, and that's what they're objecting to.
And they have concerns about it.
They have tremendous concerns about it.
Okay.
The whole library community does.
Right.
How do you protect the confidentiality of your patrons? The ability under, to gain access to those already exists if they have a judge sign off on it.
Right, get a warrant.
Yeah. they can get a warrant and they can look at it. They have that ability, so why do you need the ability to willy-nilly search all the records? I mean, you could go on witch hunts. I mean, you talk about McCarthyism.
Mm-hmm.
This is opening the door to that kind of witch hunt.
And as a veteran, particularly, do you feel this as a really sort of sharp attack on the kinds of things that you were interested in fighting for and that you did fight for?
Absolutely.
Deb, is there anything else that you'd like to say or add to this interview?
I don't know.
I
think we've covered a lot.
Well, we have. We've covered quite a bit. But there may be something that you know about, and I don't know which question to ask, and that happens.
And
that you think really would be of interest to people as the years go by and this interview becomes part of a historical record about the war and about how it's affected people's lives. There may be something that you'd like to kind of toss in that I haven't poked you with the right stick,
Right. Well, I mean, I think that the main thing is, and I go back to the word responsibility.
Okay.
That it is up to us as the people of this country to look at what goes on around us and understand that everything that happens around us affects us, and that we have to, at some point, take responsibility for either approving of or disapproving of some of the activities that do occur. People talk about drug abuse in this country. Well, if everybody in this country who is against the misuse of drugs did something about it, I think that drug abuse would abate.
Mm-hmm.
We look at crime as it happens especially in Baltimore and Washington, which are two of the most crime-ridden places in the country.
Yes.
If people take responsibility, and I don't mean a passive responsibility, I mean an active responsibility. My wife goes nuts when I start talking about this one.
Mm-hmm.
I walked into a bank about 5 years ago, mm-hmm. and it happened to be being robbed at the time.
Okay, was this in Baltimore?
Yeah, it was in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized what was happening when I recognized the tellers were distracted.
Okay.
And I saw the guy who was doing it. He saw me, see him.
Yeah.
And I just started running at him.
You just ran right at him?
Yeah. And all of a sudden, he grabbed as much money as he could. He starts running out the door. There are dollar bills and 20s flying all over the place. I'm screaming that he robbed the bank. My knees are shot. I can't run fast. And all of a sudden, people out in the street who saw what was started running after this guy.
Was he armed?
I don't know.
I mean, you didn't know?
Okay. I didn't know.
Okay, so he could have been.
He could have been.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, I mean, he was the most unfortunate robber that ever existed because... a class at the county court was letting out with undercover police officers, and he ran into about 20 of them.
It's like a Darwin Award or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And so he was captured quickly, and we took him to court,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I was asked to testify,
yes.
which I did, and we put him away for life because he was a three-time loser.
Right, right. And for again, people later on, three-time loser means... In Maryland, you must have a law.
Yeah.
That is
third time, and you're in jail for life.
Third time committing a felony.
Felony.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And you know, it's things like that. I mean, it didn't take thought. It took reaction.
Right. In fact, if you had stopped and kind of really,
if I thought about it, I would say, "Ooh."
Yeah. Maybe not.
But it's not a good idea.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is if you try to imbue in yourself and others around you that this is what the reaction should be,
mm-hmm.
then the crime, I feel, would be far less than it is now. I mean, tremendously less. And the cost to our society would be less in terms of trauma, in terms of money, in terms of everything.
And not just crime. I mean, this reminds me of you... blowing the whistle on the corrupt county down there in North Carolina.
Right.
Same kind of thing, where you just said, look, this is wrong, and I'm going to do something about it.
Right.
And do you think that that's really a key to future security of the United States, the future
if the people of this country don't take responsibility for what's happening in our society, then we have to rely on the John Ashcrofts.
Okay.
And that is a threat to our society. It's a threat to the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Well, shall we leave it there, Doug?
Sure.
Okay. You have one moment.